The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora everybody and a big welcome to today's episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood, I'm the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited. And Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. It's also broadcast at the whole of the Canterbury region on Plains Media and to the Wairarapa on Arrow FM. I've often said that topics come in waves, and it's geoengineering this time, along with several other macro issues from COP30 to what I've called joyriding on steroids, to a bit on nuclear energy, and the story of CO2 is the story of everything. Plenty to bend our minds. People have been thanking me a lot for pushing the climate barrow, and I really value that. It's great to be appreciated, as we all know, especially on big issues. But let's not think that Mike Joy, who features in a piece I've written called Dancing with the Devil, or Nate Hagans in Engineering the Earth, or even I don't think any of us are doing all that's needed. This isn't a hobby we've chosen over golf or gardening. We're scouting a future so bleak that we're driven to do our utmost in our own ways to help navigate to a less catastrophic future. Our efforts bear fruit only to the extent that we get others, like you good people, to rethink what you're doing and in your own ways, engage with the issues. So when you listen to me discussing engineering the earth, especially, I invite you to pause and reflect about our best chances of a least awful future. Then I invite you to give that serious thought when making your plans and New Year's resolutions for 2026. Okay, and Climate Matters 143. You will hear a bit on nuclear power, a different year, the same strategy. And then I think I promised something on the story of CO2 is the story of everything. A little bit of a touch base on horse meat, and then Dancing with the Devil, the crazy cost of our indulgences. That's a reasonably long read for people reading the Substack version. And then Engineering the Earth. Is it time to think the unthinkable? And let's start with a quiz. What is SAI and what is its significance for climate? What is SAI and what is its significance for climate? And if you have your ears pricked, you will hear the answer to that in one of the items that's coming up. Nuclear power, different year. Same strategy, and then a little bit more on that. Now, just to put that a little bit in context, in Daniela's interviews, which you may not have heard by now, she refers to the nuclear power lobby as presenting like they were young activists with a cool climate fix. So, you know, there were serious nuclear power lobby, but they was coming across as people who were animated, and yep, we've got the answer. So in an interesting coincidence, just the day after I interviewed Daniela, I was having lunch with a group, and one of the people at lunch mentioned going to a previous COP many years ago, and she particularly mentioned the nuclear industry as being represented by, wait for it, well-trained young people with almost evangelical advocacy for the, quotes, clean, close quotes, nuclear industry. So they might each year look like they're fresh advocates, but it's the same policy, same approach. They must feel it works for them. And they're probably also playing a very long game on their industry. And I'm also going to quote a bit from Hannah Ritchie. In fact, this Climate Matters has got several references to Hannah Ritchie, where she was interviewed by Yale Environment 360, which is another organization that I quite often quote. And Hannah Ritchie, who's of our world and data fame, she shone some interesting light on nuclear power. that the real issues and cost and logistics, not safety in her view. I'm quoting, "Burning fossil fuels through air pollution kills millions of people every single year." And you compare that to the biggest nuclear disasters we've had. No one died in Three Mile Island. No one died directly from Fukushima, even though a tsunami hit the nuclear power plant. And then she goes on to say, the key challenge is one, cost, and two, construction time. And Dana Ritchie didn't mention the astronomical climate impact of fossil fuels, nor did she question whether we might actually be better to reduce our energy demand. So much for nuclear power. Just a quick bit of feedback on horse meat. You may remember the last Climate Matters, 142. We had a little bit about maybe saving emissions by eating horse instead of beef. Well, I wound up talking to a friend called Matthew, and he knows animals really well. I'm always really impressed with his knowledge of animal behavior. And he put a different perspective on the horse meat versus beef debate. I'm quoting, "Horses are highly inefficient feeders," he had told me, explaining that they likely eat three times the grass that cows do to grow the same amount of meat. That certainly shifts the balance when you're considering the viability of it all. But then I did a little bit more due diligence. I found several research papers comparing beef or cow meat and horse, and I'll give a link to one or two. And they point in a similar direction to Matthew, but less strongly, and they suggest it's less clear-cut than he does. Horses feed 50% longer in a day than cattle. They eat the grass shorter, and so they manage to outcompete the cows. And on the same feed, the research found that mares generally have better weight gain, but foals less than their bovine counterparts. So nothing is simple, is it? Okay, time to back out of that rabbit hole and get on to the next one, the story of everything. It's hard to imagine a worthy sequel to Peter Brennan's astonishing book, The Ends of the World. You may remember I waxed lyrical about that a few episodes ago. But his next book, The Story of CO2 is the Story of Everything, is just such a worthy sequel. It's got an even more complex narrative, and it ties, get a load of this, the second law of thermodynamics and tectonics to the ebb and flow of life and the rise and fall of atmospheric CO2. Sounds boring? It's anything but. And Brennan's terrific, evocative descriptions breathe vitality into both the astonishing, such as snowball Earth, and into the mundane, such as a billion years of gunge coating big parts of the Earth. The book's full of intrigue and surprise. For example, I thought snowball Earth was a science fiction concept, but it really happened. And I'd never thought of Homo sapiens as an ice age species, but we are, and that has a big bearing on how well we'll fare in a warming climate. But perhaps the biggest takeaway is we are playing with fire on steroids. Our present human effort, that's in terms of burning fossil fuels, is like exploding millions of years of accumulated energy in just a heartbeat. We're adding carbon dioxide to the air 10 times faster than in what's known as the Great Dying. That's the end Permian extinction 250 million years ago, and that is the biggest of the mass extinctions, and we're currently emitting CO2 about 100 times faster than most of those other mass extinctions. Very serious stuff. Okay, Dancing with the Devil, the daunting price of our indulgence. Mike Joy, I've referred to Mike before, he's best known as a freshwater scientist in New Zealand, but he also joins a lot of other dots. He's very good at cutting through the BS around things and at grounding discussions in the basic core issues. He recently put up a LinkedIn post, which we'll give a link to, and he didn't pull any punches. I'm quoting, "The latest forecast by Airbus is that more than 40,000 new jetliners will be needed between 2023 and 2042. 40,000 new jetliners in 20 years. I'll give you a link to an Airbus forecast, and I think it's the one that Mike drew his information from, and also to a one-page summary in case the full forecast is too much, and I'm quoting from Airbus this time. Over the next 20 years, we anticipate a global demand for 43,420 new passenger and freighter aircraft. That's actually equivalent to adding a large plane to the air travel fleet every 4 hours, day and night, for 20 years. Airbus actually notes several things that drive this increase, and the first one they put down is just people, they say, with an exclamation mark after it, commenting that 1.5 billion more people will be in the middle classes, and they're the classes they think are the likeliest demographic to actually travel by air. And they give an unconvincing nod to the environment. I'm quoting, "Crucial replacements of older, less fuel-efficient fleets." Sure, we want less fuel-efficient fleets, but you've heard me talk before about Jevons paradox, and that will suggest that it will be good business for Airbus. They'll sell a lot more planes, and instead of saving a whole lot of fuel and emissions, what will happen is there'll be an increase in flying and not an overall reduction in fuel use. The crazy escalation of routes is illustrated by an image that you won't be able to see, but in India, two maps of India, one in 2014 showing all the air routes in India, and one in 2024, with three times the number of routes arising in just 10 years. But that's not the end of Mike Joy's post. He then goes on, and I'm quoting, "Orders for 56 massive diesel-powered cruise ships were signed up by August 2023, and most will not be launched before 2030. So let's join the dots on that. In 2019, Transport and the Environment, that's an organization, published an article that said luxury cruise giant emits 10 times more air pollution, that's what they call SOx, or oxides of sulfur, emits 10 times more air pollution than all of Europe's cars. Let's just get more of a handle on that. Carnival is the world's largest cruise company. It currently has 29 ships, and Europe has approaching 300 million cars. So each ship emits equivalent sulfur oxides to about 10 million cars. Have you got that? One cruise ship is polluting the air to the similar extent to 10 million cars. But just note that sulfur oxides, they're serious pollutants, but they're not generally greenhouse gases. The International Council for Clean Transportation also compared 7-day luxury cruises with a 7-day luxury road trip in an SUV and staying in upmarket hotels, and included connecting flights for both trips. The best cruises, I quote best meaning lowest emission cruises, had nearly 2.5 times the emissions of the worst road trip. And that went up if you excluded the connecting flights. And let's not for a moment think that luxury SUV holidays are okay for the climate. They're at the wrong end of the scale and just shows how bad cruise ships are. And so what's a key takeaway from all of this? Well, nearly all of the consequent emissions are discretionary, from people spending their spare cash. It's just for people having fun. It's not working or doing business or enriching their communities. Hence, I call it the price of indulgence. And it brings to mind a quote I've mentioned before, I think, from Flip Grater, heading a press article of hers earlier in the year. If you're not waking up every single morning and trying to save our planet, what exactly are you doing? Right, we're now heading into a rabbit hole, quite an important rabbit hole. Please bear with us. This is the final piece in today's episode. Engineering the Earth, is it time to think the unthinkable? If you mention geoengineering to almost anyone engaged seriously with climate issues, their eyes will roll and they'll probably muster a condescending look and try and change the subject. If you mention it to almost anyone else, the chances are they won't know what you're talking about. So what is it? Geoengineering is the deliberate, large-scale intervention in the Earth's climate to counteract climate change. It's commonly split into two broad categories: solar radiation modification, which are things that reflect more sunlight back into space, and the other one is carbon capture and storage, which we have talked about before, which is equipment or systems that suck carbon dioxide out of the air and have processes for keeping it out so it's not emitted back. Let's look quickly at CCS, carbon capture and storage. We're familiar with trees absorbing CO2. The carbon gets stored in the timber until it either rots or burns. And many other natural processes help as well. We can think of soil regeneration. Rock weathering is a biggie, as the story of CO2 is the story of everything, says a lot about. But carbon capture and storage falls desperately short of counteracting the enormous carbon dioxide explosion caused by our fossil fuel frenzy, which is why scientists and engineers are spending a fortune, often as government grants, developing devices to remove carbon dioxide from the air. They've got some success with carbon dioxide concentrated close to industrial processes, such as coal-fired electricity generation. And lots of hype and lots of pilot projects, but far less success trying to suck carbon dioxide out of the air with man-made equipment. All up, man-made CCS systems remove about 1/1000th of what's needed and offer little prospect of serious upscaling. So where does that leave us? Well, let's turn to the unthinkable. Suggestions about deliberately changing the atmosphere to reflect more sunlight are almost invariably met with overpowering skepticism at the improbability of it and horror at the prospect of such a vast experiment going terribly wrong, which is exactly how Nate Hagans opened a long conversation with Professor Ted Parson. We'll not only give you a link to that, but I will really encourage you to listen carefully to it, even though it takes over an hour. However, first of all, we'll go to Hannah Ritchie again, and here are comments on this. Quoting, "We currently have insufficient information on the potential impacts of solar geoengineering." Then she goes on to say, "I don't think the odds are that low that over the next 50 years, a country might decide on their own they're going to do this." And in fact, Ted Parson suggests odds as high as 90% that SAI will be undertaken in the next few decades. So did you get that SAI? That's the answer to the quiz, and it refers to stratospheric aerosol injection. Parson makes an impressive case, in fact. Essentially, it is, we've run out of time to keep the world livable by just slashing fossil fuels. We desperately need to buy time to get our oil and coal and gas habits under control and stratospheric aerosol injection, which releases chemicals into the upper atmosphere to form reflective aerosols, might offer our best chance. Parson describes, for example, fleets of 200 huge jet planes running, as he says, like dump trucks to deliver 10 million tons of sulfur dioxide a year into the upper atmosphere 20 kilometers or more up. That's more than twice the height of Mount Everest. To be honest, the idea sends a shiver down my spine, but I'm persuaded by him. And that puts a mind-bending perspective on the climate crisis. When we're facing such an apocalyptic climate future, that our best chance is squirting millions of tons of reflective chemicals high into the air, and our government is hell-bent on policies that make the climate crisis worse, we really have to question the sanity of our government. Parson actually cites the 1991 eruption of Mount Pinatubo as an important natural example. It ejected 15 million tons of aerosol producing sulfur dioxide into the air and actually up right up into the stratosphere. But get this, over the next 15 months, NASA explains that they measured a drop in the average global temperature of about 0.6 degrees Celsius. That's huge when we're currently sitting on 1.5 degrees Celsius of global overheating. But I've included in the Substack issue illustrations from NASA that just show how Mount Pinatubo, the aerosols from it spread around the globe. And Hankins and Parson also covered a whole lot more important detail in their long podcast, especially on risk associated with SAI. But I'm not going to try and go into it more here. I really recommend you listen to it. Of course, we'll provide the link. I will just add one thing, though, and that is that in the June 28th New Scientist, they discussed also the benefits of using rockets rather than planes to take the aerosols even higher, as in 50 kilometers up. And they also included a piece which they called How to Think About Geoengineering. One thing to think, I think, is that the taboo around discussing geoengineering is waning. And on that note, I'm going to finish this Climate Matters. Thank you so much for your company. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope I enjoy it again next week. As you know, Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz. Thanks again for your company. Kia kaha for the climate.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.